Good afternoon. I'm Doug Cox, and on behalf of the D.C. Lawyers Chapter, welcome to our July luncheon. It really is amazing that we can attract such a large crowd on a hot summer day at the end of a holiday week. In this chapter, in July, we traditionally sponsor a roundup of the recently completed Supreme Court term. And a key part of that tradition is that the roundup is given by Ted Olson, former Solicitor General of the United States, good friend of the Society, and past president of this chapter. Although the press of circumstances has kept him from the podium for the last 2 years, we're delighted he's returned today. Obviously, the entire term has been overshadowed by the healthcare decision, which for significance, drama, and even mystery, far exceeded anyone's wildest expectations. As prominent healthcare supporter and former Senator Ted Kennedy looks up at us today, I think he is happy with the court's decision. It is fair to say, however, that the decision was greeted in other quarters with more than a few fleeting expletives. Among the many bad things that flow from the decision was it gave pundits and reporters the opportunity to once again misreport the vote in Bush versus Gore. They keep saying it's 5-4, but as every schoolboy knows, it was 7-2. Also part of the drama of that last decision day was the decision in United States versus Alvarez, the case involving the Stolen Valor Act and a congenital liar who falsely claimed, among other things, that he held the Congressional Medal of Honor. The Stolen Valor Act was struck down 6-3. It wasn't a 5-4 cliffhanger. So why was it held to the very last day? Perhaps because it was a necessary prerequisite to, and indeed a companion to, the healthcare decision. The healthcare decision, of course, upheld Obamacare on the ground that the mandate was a tax. That's where Alvarez comes in. The very first line of the opinion says of Mr. Alvarez, lying was his habit. The court goes on to conclude that lying is constitutionally protected, and its efforts to sell healthcare, lying was also the administration's habit. But what the heck? For the majority of the court, that's okay. We can assume that Congress will be eager to grasp its new power. We can look forward to the Violence Against Women Tax Act and the Gun-Free School Zones Tax Act. And of course, on the theory that the tax power is the latest route to lawfulness and a big winner, rumor has it that Eric Holder is prepared to argue that Fast and Furious was a tax. I'm sure Ted will have a lot to say about healthcare, but he will also draw us back to the term's other important decisions. Nina Totenberg, I think by now, is most famous for having described Ted as the rock star of the Supreme Court bar. In 2004, at the time of Ted's resignation from his position as Solicitor General, she stated, quote, "By everyone's reckoning, he's done an outstanding job." During his service as Solicitor General, Ted racked up an amazing 82% win rate, the kind of winning percentage that other solicitors and acting solicitors can only dream about. Ted received his law degree from the University of California, Berkeley, and joined Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in its Los Angeles office. In 1981, he was appointed by President Reagan to serve as Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. Upon returning to private practice, he joined Gibson Dunn's Washington office, where he led the firm's appellate practice until his confirmation as Solicitor General. After serving as Solicitor General, he once again returned to Gibson Dunn, where he continues his appellate and constitutional law practice and also leads the firm's crisis management practice. He is a fellow of both the American College of Trial Lawyers and the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers. Since he was last with us, he has continued to be widely recognized for his accomplishments in the law. In 2010, amazingly, Time magazine ranked Ted as one of the 100 most influential people in the entire world. But hey, it's just Time Magazine. And Lady Gaga also made the list. So maybe you have to take it with a grain of salt. That was 2010. Now in 2011, Ted received the American Bar Association Medal for distinguished service to the cause of American jurisprudence for his work in connection with the Task Force on Preservation of the Judicial System. But hey, this is just the ABA. David Boies shared in the award, and so perhaps it too has to be taken with a grain of salt. I think with significantly greater substance, in December 2011, Ted was chosen by Washingtonian Magazine as the Capitol's, quote, number one lawyer. For years, court observers, bowing to the influence of Justice Kennedy, have accepted that constitutional analysis must be characterized by the pursuit of one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. That's no longer true. Now, court observers must go on a frightening journey, in the words of the healthcare dissenters, deep into the forbidden land of the sophists. All of us might well choose Ted as the best possible guide on that journey. Ted.
Thank you, Doug. I'm never sure that to be flattered or embarrassed or the fact that he's taken away all my material. I'll just correct you on one thing, Doug. You should remember this. The Bush versus Gore case, which everybody says is 5-4, was really 9-0 the first time the Supreme Court heard the case, and then it was 7-2. So really, and I want you all to remember this and don't forget it, is the Bush versus Gore is 16-2. I'm reminded when Doug says those nice things about these things that I've done, of what they say when you're in government, that they praise you twice during your tenure, the day that you arrive and the day that you leave. And in private life, I'm finding that you're presented with awards like the ABA Medal, largely for two reasons. As a fundraiser to entice your friends and law firm to give money to causes that they would otherwise much prefer to ignore, or because they have an annual honor to dispense and everyone older has already received the award or died. The next step I fear in my career is a job as a school crossing guard someplace, and I hope it's in Laguna Beach. As you know, we generally commence, at least some of you, each year's Supreme Court roundup with recognition of a particularly notable example of public hypocrisy, crassness, self-aggrandizement, or self-immolation, or all of these things at once, as in the case of John Edwards. As usual, the candidates this year were plentiful. The thing about this award is that we could bestow it every week and still have our hands full. And modern technology seems to have acted as an accelerator for this type of behavior, as witnessed by the number of public figures who seem to be compelled to leave vulgar and threatening voicemail messages for their ex-wives, distribute repulsive photographs of their body parts to strangers over devices known as smartphones, which invariably seem to come into the possession of dumb people. Or arrange assassinations with FBI agents or producers of reality television shows masquerading as prepubescent children. You probably have your own candidates for this award, such as attention-starved starlets who shoplift on camera while on probation for drug offenses, or highly paid bankers who entrust billions of dollars to subordinates who have peculiar nicknames and who send embarrassing, self-incriminating emails to every single person they know. So by now you get the drift, and our award winner this year will be drawn from one of the many journalists and law professors who first claimed that the Obama healthcare law was unquestionably constitutional. and who then widely and loudly proclaimed after the oral argument that the measure would certainly be overturned by five activist, unprincipled, demented Republican zealots on the Supreme Court, and who then last week pronounced the beatification of Chief Justice John Roberts, who was, as they knew all along, a noble, nonpartisan, far-seeing, principled genius of a statesman who saved the court and the Union by placing the integrity and independence of the court above such things as the law and ideology. These, by the way, are quotes. So this describes numerous journalists, experts, and academicians, all of whom are, every single one of whom is untainted by ever having argued a case in the United States Supreme Court. But their leader in this instance, and I think you know who I'm talking about, is CNN and New Yorker legal correspondent, pundit Jeff Toobin, who raced who raced to the cameras in savage Solicitor General Don Varelli's oral argument as a train wreck, and then the next day a plane wreck. Comments immediately repeated and amplified by all of his colleagues. The allegedly disastrous oral argument, which was nothing of the sort, now, of course, is completely forgotten. According to Toobin, the Chief Justice's reliance on the taxing power was flawed, but it led to what Toobin pronounced to be the correct result. After all, he said, any port in a constitutional storm will do. The outcome, never mind the analysis, was, he said, a singular act of courage. Well, your speaker last year, Miguel Estrada, had the difficult task of summarizing what he characterized as the most boring term in decades. My task is not like that. I submit, though, it's even harder, as we have just completed one of the most exciting and memorable terms in decades. But before we turn the events of this term, a word about the court itself I thought I might share with you. It's in September of 2005, John Roberts became the 17th Chief Justice in our nation's 220-year history. Imagine 44 presidents and only 17 Chief Justices. Three new justices took office since then, Justices Alito, Sotomayor, and Kagan, replacing Justices O'Connor, Souter, and Stevens, respectively. Prior to the Roberts appointment, the court had not had a new justice in over 12 years, a record for a nine-justice court. The court has now had four new justices in 7 years. Three are in their 50s, two in their 60s, and four in their 70s. The oldest is Justice Ginsburg at 79. The youngest, Justice Kagan, is 52. Last week, the New York Times called this an older, more conservative court. The paper naturally had a chart which purported to prove that it was an older and more conservative court. But the court is actually neither older nor more conservative. The last four justices at the time of their appointment were collectively 103 years younger than the justices they replaced, not older, younger. And this term's controversial decisions were about evenly split between the conservatives and the liberals. Of course, the Times sees court decisions as moderate, the ones that they like, and those that they don't like as radical or ultra-conservative. So the average for the New York Times is far to their right. By some standards, this is a very diverse court. Three justices are women, two Italian-Americans, one African-American, one Hispanic, and three Jewish. Not long ago, each of these groups were largely foreclosed from positions of authority in the United States. By another standard, however, the court is extraordinarily homogeneous. Eight of the nine justices, all but Justice Kagan, have been federal appeals court judges, four from the D.C. Circuit alone, and one each from the First, Second, Third, and Ninth Circuits. Note the East Coast tilt: Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and D.C. You can get to all of those places on the Acela. Not one of the justices ever held public office, and none served in the executive branch in a position higher than Solicitor General or head of the EEOC. By contrast, in 1953, the Brown versus Board of Education court consisted of only one former appeals court judge, one ex-governor, three ex-senators, two former attorneys general, one ex-SEC commission chair, and one academic. Quite a different composition of the court, a different paradigm. Amazingly, six justices of the current United States Supreme Court went to Harvard Law School, three to Yale. Six have taught law school, six attended Ivy League colleges as undergraduates, three from Princeton alone. Nine resumes of the current justices contain the names Harvard, Yale, or Princeton a total of 13 times. Add one from Cornell and you can see that this is an overwhelmingly Ivy League, Ivy Tower, and Northeastern court. Chief Justice Roberts joked last week that he was headed for Malta, which he characterized as an impregnable island fortress. Where does he think he's been this year? There are six Catholics and three Jewish justices. For the first time in history, no Protestants. Remarkable considering the not too distant history of Jewish and Catholic discrimination in this country. I must observe, however, that I have never seen a hint of religious dogma creeping into court decisions, either now or any time in the past. Stunningly, four of the five boroughs of New York City are represented on the United States Supreme Court. Is this a good thing? Justice Kagan from Manhattan, Justice Sotomayor from the Bronx, Justice Scalia from Queens, and Justice Ginsburg from Brooklyn. Anyone want to wager that the next justice will come from Princeton, Harvard, the D.C. Circuit, and Staten Island? Incidentally, the justices select clerks who are younger replicas of themselves. For this term, 12 of the 36 are from Harvard, 24 of the 36 from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, or Virginia. Overwhelmingly, and also from federal appeals courts before their presence on the United States Supreme Court. 23 of the 36 Supreme Court clerks this year came from just five federal circuits, for the 2nd, 4th, 6th, 9th, and the District of Columbia Circuit. There are three women on the court for the first time in history. Justice O'Connor was the very first in 1981. Of the last 11 appointments, four have been women. Justice Scalia celebrated his 25th year on the court this term. Justice Thomas, his 20th. This has indeed been a momentous term for opinions, and we'll get to some of the most significant cases in a few moments. But overall, the court rendered decisions with opinions after argument in 67 cases, including many quite important decisions in areas we do not have time to discuss today, such as patent, copyright, civil litigation, criminal procedure, redistricting, and separation of powers. According to my calculations, the court was unanimous or had only one dissent in over half of these cases, 34 of them. There were three or four dissents on the other side of the spectrum in one-third of the cases. In the closest, most deeply divided controversial cases, the winners were about evenly split between conservatives and liberals, with Justice Kennedy once again and Chief Justice Roberts generally on the prevailing side. Everyone may now be pronouncing this to be the Roberts Court, but according to my count, Justice Kennedy was in the losing column in only one of the key 5-4 cases. In his nine opinions that he wrote for the court, six were decided by three with three or four dissents. In other words, he was getting the controversial cases. He is still the must-have vote in closed cases on the Supreme Court. Now, I don't know if you still care, nor will you be surprised, but the Ninth Circuit, that always gets a laugh just saying the Ninth Circuit, was reversed 18 times, nine times unanimously or with only one dissent. But it is getting better. It was actually affirmed four times, and several of its reversals were close calls. Nevertheless, maybe the Ninth Circuit should consider getting more judges from Harvard or Yale. The government had one of its worst years in recent memory. I have not gone back to compare records, but the government usually wins well over two-thirds of its cases, exceeding 80% in some years. This year, if you figure the divided results in the Arizona case and in the Obamacare case, the Obama administration lost approximately 15 of the 27 cases in which it was a party, a batting average of about 45%. Of the merits cases it's lost, 9 were decided unanimously, or with only one dissent. Not counting the divided decisions in Arizona and Obamacare, the votes in the government's losing cases went against the administration 106 to 19. The government did somewhat better in cases it chose to enter as amicus, prevailing in 11 of 19, but still coming in less than 60%. I hasten to say that I have the utmost respect for Solicitor General Don Varelli and the superlative lawyers in the Solicitor General's office. This was a year of tough, controversial, and close cases. With this portfolio, much of which the Solicitor General has very little choice about, I really doubt that anybody could have done any better, but this was a tough year. Now, speaking of turning to the major decisions, it is difficult to choose among the cases to feature from the court's rich docket, so I'm sure I will miss some of your favorites. That's going to be inevitable. But let me start in the criminal justice field. I decided on the even number amendments to the Bill of Rights, and not including the Second Amendment because it didn't happen this year for the Second Amendment, the Fourth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments. First of all, the Fourth Amendment and the GPS device fastened on the drug dealer or alleged drug dealer's car. A unanimous court produced divergent approaches to the increasing collision between modern technology and the right to be protected from intrusive searches in a case called U.S. versus Jones. The five-justice majority, led by Justice Scalia, rejected a warrantless government installation of a GPS tracking device on the car of a suspected drug dealer. Justice Scalia reasoned that installing the device on the car was akin to a trespass, which violated the right to be secure in one's effects, the car, against an unreasonable search. The majority declined to accept the government's argument that the target had no reasonable expectation of privacy in where he traveled on public roads in his car. He could have been followed, he could have been trailed in various different ways. Instead of this standard, Justice Scalia's originalist approach focused on the trespass concept of privacy prevalent when the Fourth Amendment was adopted. Justice Alito's concurring opinion scoffed at Justice Scalia's obsession with what the framers would have considered to be a Fourth Amendment violation. He alluded to modern technology such as satellites, lasers, video monitoring, thermal imaging devices, smartphones, and automatic toll collection mechanisms, to mention just a few. It's really quite frightening if you read that opinion about all the ways the government can track us. As he did during oral argument in the violent video game case last term, he mocked Justice Scalia's reliance on original understanding to solve problems of modern technology. He poked fun at Justice Scalia with a colorful metaphor of a tiny constable secreted in a gigantic coach in 1791, following the, I don't know if it would be a drug dealer then or whoever around. The only answer, he concluded, is to rely on reasonable expectations of privacy rather than 18th century tort law. Justice Alito, while consistently resistant to pleas of First Amendment violations, is proving to be highly sensitive to claims of invasion of privacy under the Fourth Amendment. In another widely noted Fourth Amendment case, a 5-4 court led by Justice Kennedy upheld suspicionless strip searches by jailers of arrestees, including those arrested for simply minor offenses. Justice Kennedy, you may recall, wrote the opinion a few years ago upholding the drug testing for high school athletes. He may be a civil libertarian in First Amendment cases, but he leans far the other way in Fourth Amendment cases. Ultimately, this case boiled down to the problem of line drawing. If there are good reasons to search arrested persons for drugs other contraband or weapons, where does one draw the line between persons who present serious threats and those who don't? This is a little like the handcuffs that they put on, that I've heard that they put on you when you're arrested. The one person an arresting officer decides to be nice to is possibly the person who will take that officer's head off. Justice Kennedy pointed out, for example, that Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh was originally pulled over for driving a vehicle without a license plate. Better to eliminate the discretion and search them all. In the Sixth Amendment, in the annual back and forth over whether the Confrontation Clause allows the government to present extrajudicial, non-testimonial evidence in the form of police reports, third-party confessions, and lab reports in criminal cases, this is an area that evokes Justice Scalia's passionate originalist views of the Bill of Rights. He adamantly insists that the Confrontation Clause almost invariably includes a right to confront evidence in the form of witnesses who may then be cross-examined. He's won most of these battles, but lost a few recently, including a very acerbic exchange last term with Justice Sotomayor, who came up the other way. It's kind of fun to read that case just for the level of the rhetoric that Justice Scalia brought to bear in dissent. And this term's battle he lost over DNA lab test results. Justices Alito, Breyer, and Kennedy were lined up against him this time, along with the Chief Justice and Justice Thomas. Justice Scalia assigned the dissent to Justice Kagan, who wrote a lengthy and persuasive analysis. She started with a description of an earlier California case involving the same laboratory that was involved in this case, which had furnished a report which fingered a suspect in a rape case based upon a bloody sweatshirt. Upon a cross-examination, the DNA analyst realized she'd made a mortifying error, in her words, confusing the suspect's blood and the victim's blood. Our Constitution, Justice Kagan said, contains a mechanism for catching such errors, the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause. But Justice Scalia won his other Sixth Amendment signature battle, which stems from the 2000 decision in Apprendi versus New Jersey, holding that evidence used to increase a penalty beyond its statutory minimum must be presented to a jury, not simply decided by a judge. In this year's case, Southern Union versus United States, the court ruled 6-3 that the Apprendi rule applies to substantial criminal fines. Justice Sotomayor wrote for the court, joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Scalia, Thomas, Ginsburg, and Kagan. Justice Breyer wrote the dissent for himself and Justices Kennedy. The Apprendi cases are turning out to be another long-running doctrinal dispute with Justice Scalia on the one side, the originalist, and Justice Breyer on the other side. Justice Breyer is clearly influenced on this issue by his years on the Sentencing Commission, developing guidelines for the sentencing by judges, which, as you may recall, Justice Scalia thought was unconstitutional. So it's an interesting to see where they pair up on these cases. I've not scrutinized this case carefully yet, but our lawyers will certainly do so because we'll be interested in seeing whether its reasoning can be applied in some measure to civil fines and punitive damages. In its leading Eighth Amendment case, this term, a 5-4 court held that the cruel and unusual punishment clause prohibited excessive sanctions. Thus, punishment for a crime must be graduated and proportional to both the offender and the offense. And therefore, the court ruled the Eighth Amendment forbids sentencing a juvenile to life in prison without the possibility of parole, even for an offense involving homicide. Note that the Eighth Amendment prohibits excessive fines and excessive bail, but cruel and unusual punishment. The concept of excessiveness has been imported from the bail and fine clauses into the cruel and unusual clause. This was Justice Kagan's most significant decision in her 2 years on the court. This is the latest in the line of juvenile cases, sentencing cases, stemming from the highly controversial juvenile death penalty case, Kennedy opinion, in Roper versus Simmons in 2005, which popularized the evolving standards of decency rule. Chief Justice Roberts' dissent pointed out that the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishments. The life without possibility of parole sentence is being served today by 2,500 prisoners, generally because federal law and the law of most states permit it. Thus, the sentence could not possibly be unusual based on an objective, this is the test, objective indicia of society's standards as expressed in legislative enactments and state practice, which was the test at least until 2 weeks ago. The focus in Miller on excessive sanctions and graduated and proportional punishment under the Eighth Amendment has not and will not in the future be limited to juveniles and, in my view, will not be limited to exclusively to criminal punishments. This is another area which is certain to be examined by lawyers litigating other criminal punishments. Solitary confinement might be the next one, and arguably excessive fines, civil fines, as well, again, as punitive damages. As it does every year, the court examined the scope of the First Amendment. One of these cases was not FCC versus Fox. As much as I would like to talk about fleeting expletives and naked female anatomy, the court ducked the First Amendment issue in that case for the second time, possibly hoping that the case would come back yet again, or possibly hoping that the case would go away and stay away. I'm not sure which. But as I will explain in more detail in a few moments, the court ruled in that case that the FCC failed to give the networks fair notice prior to the broadcasts that fleeting expletives and momentary nudity, aren't these great concepts, can be found to be actionably indecent. Of course the broadcasters knew that. Why do you think they broadcast that stuff? The court struck a blow in another First Amendment case for religious liberty in Hosanna Tabor versus EEOC, rejecting an Americans with Disabilities Act claim against a Lutheran church school on the grounds that the plaintiff was a member of the clergy and thus subject to the exclusive control of her church as to whether and under what circumstances she could be removed as a minister. The government's exceedingly broad claim to impose federal law on the personnel and management decisions of the church were strongly rejected by a unanimous Supreme Court, speaking through the Chief Justice. This case is important because it upholds the Free Exercise Clause objection to interference by the government in the church's right to select its ministers, and the Establishment Clause objection to the exercise of government power to determine who might be a minister. Both concepts would be involved in the case. The court rejected as untenable and remarkable the government's view that the church's rights should be analyzed under the First Amendment's Association Clause as if it were a labor union or a social club. In some respects, looking at this case, the government's arguments in here, in this case, may reveal something about its attitudes towards religious freedom underlying the Obama administration's running conflict with churches over what kind of health insurance they must pay for and provide. We now come to the two decisions from this term that seem to upset the left the most. Despite all the wailing, fist-pounding, and teeth-gnashing about the right-wing Republicans on the court ruining the republic, the left won the Obamacare mandate, most of the immigration case, prevailed in limiting the sentences of murderous minors, obtained a 9-0 decision in the GPS surveillance case, and extended the rights to criminal defendants in four separate ineffective assistance of counsel cases. So which two decisions inflamed the liberals the most? One involved union dues. The court held in Knox versus Service Employees International that when unions impose dues assessments that were not disclosed in the regular course, they must provide advance notice and may not exact funds from non-members for political or ideological causes without the affirmative consent of those being assessed. In short, compulsory subsidies may not be used to force the endorsement by non-members of political and ideological ends they do not support. Opting out, the court said, is not the answer. Opting in is the only acceptable constitutional course. Justice Sotomayor and Ginsburg concurred on part of the opting out, opting in part, but strenuously objected, as did the other two dissenting justices, that the question the court decided was not incorporated within the question presented, and you're going to hear a lot of language about the court violating its own rules. But I'll skip that over. The decision at its core inhibits unions from taking advantage of agency shops under which all employees are represented by a union selected by a majority of the workforce, whether they like it or not, by assessing fees for political advocacy. The liberals and their allies went ballistic. Alito's, this is the words of the Washington Post, Alito's ruling struck at the heart of unionism, stemming, it asserted, from fear and loathing of workers' organizations. You could see they were upset. The decision particularly unsettled the left, coming from the same Gang of Five. You can see how they feel about the Gang of Five, and I guess you could guess who the Gang of Five is, as the New York Times labeled them, who summarily reversed the Montana Supreme Court's attempt to overrule the court's earlier Citizens United decision. The radical Supreme Court, the Times railed, five conservative justices have made the court an aggressive political actor. The thing that makes the left so mad about these decisions that each in a different way strips away legal barriers to freer and less inhibited participation in the political process. Unions control the viewpoints of their members by using compulsory dues for the political purposes selected by union leaders. Knox stops that process with respect to non-members and even makes it more difficult to conscript the resources of members for ideological ends with which they may not agree. Citizens United, on the other hand, allows individuals working together through corporations to express views concerning candidates for political election, and the left is fearful that these independent expenditures will be tilted to the right. In fact, the big money this year is coming from individuals, not big corporations, which mostly avoid political controversies whenever they can. But these inconvenient facts, to borrow an expression I heard somewhere else, has not stilled the rhetoric. So the two decisions that I'm talking about inhibit friendly money to the left and liberate hostile money to the left for the right. No wonder they're so mad. Citizens United, of course, is the most hated, so far at least, of any recent Supreme Court decision, even more than Bush versus Gore. I don't have time to say everything I'd like about Citizens United. People around me say, don't get him started, which so unsettled the president that he rudely, angrily, and inaccurately called out the justices about the case while they were a captive televised audience during his State of the Union address. I won't resist saying a word or two, however, about the hypocrisy of the critics. Here it comes, Joe. The New York Times, just an example, regularly expends immense resources to take political positions distributed nationally daily. It is a corporation, richly financed, incidentally, by a wealthy Mexican, which is nothing I'm against, except that they're considerably exercised about the possibility of foreign money. But they're a corporation financed by that individual, in part, that makes unlimited and unrestricted political expenditures during federal elections in order to influence the outcome of these elections. There is no doubt about it. And the editors won't admit it, but these pieces of advocacy appear occasionally in the news pages as well as the editorial pages. Ask John McCain. And the Times is among the greatest beneficiaries of constitutional protections given to corporations. See, for example, New York Times versus Sullivan and the Pentagon Papers case. Yet the Times and other major left-of-center publishers regularly rant about Citizens United decision that gave those same constitutional free speech rights to corporations such as the ACLU, the NRA, Citizens United, and the owner of your neighborhood hardware store. The loudest voices against Citizens United are the ones who benefit the most from the legalized monopoly over public opinion that they held as long as other corporations were not allowed to express the same views regularly expressed by the nation's liberal press. I will simply say that if the left wants to do away with Citizens United, the outcome should apply the same rules in the future to corporations that own the New York Times and MSNBC as to little Citizens United. One final First Amendment case. In U.S. versus Alvarez, Justice Kennedy spoke for a divided court in overturning a federal law that prohibited falsely claiming having received certain military decorations such as the Medal of Honor. The plurality of the case distinguished cases upholding prohibitions of false statements in other contexts which are prohibited and upheld. As a content-based restrictions on protected speech, strict scrutiny, the plurality applied. I'm having trouble with that word. I've never had it before, but you make me nervous. Justice Breyer and Kagan applied something called intermediate scrutiny to government restrictions on false statements of fact, but also finding the statute invalid. Now, as I count it, we're up to something like four levels of scrutiny. We have strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, rational basis scrutiny, and then something I just discovered was between rational basis scrutiny and intermediate scrutiny. We've got to stop this. Justice Alito authored a dissent in that case. Justice Alito has now dissented and often has been the sole dissenter in numerous free speech cases involving, for example, videos of animal cruelty and obnoxious protests at military funerals. Whereas Justice Kennedy has emerged as the court's most vigilant defender of uninhibited free expression, Justice Alito falls on the opposite end of that spectrum. A concurring, this is one I invite you to read, a concurring Ninth Circuit opinion by Chief Judge Kaczynski in the Stolen Valor case is worth reading for his catalog. It's a full page worth of various ways in which you lie for socially useful purposes, such as to protect one's privacy, to avoid hurt feelings, to make others feel better, to avoid being lonely, to make an exit, to set up a surprise party, to curry favor, and so on. He says, quote, "Saints may always tell the truth, but for mortals, living means lying." It's almost as if he'd tried all of these things himself. Separation of powers and preemption, Justice Kennedy, yes, him again, authored the court's divided decision upholding one provision of Arizona's attempt to control the consequences of wholesale illegal immigration into the state of Arizona, a responsibility the federal government has largely abdicated. Indeed, as the record established, there was an epidemic of crime, safety risks, stolen serious property damage, and environmental problems associated with illegal immigration across private land from Mexico into Arizona. The provision the court upheld required mandatory immigration status checks during the course of an otherwise lawful detention, where there was reasonable suspicion that the detained person was an alien and unlawfully present in the United States. The Obama administration, I understand, has now retaliated, immediately suspending its cooperation with Arizona in supplying information as to the immigration status of detained individuals. I think I heard that right. The provisions which the court found to be preempted created state law penalties for conduct prescribed by federal law, added penalties for unauthorized aliens soliciting or performing work, and allowed arrests where probable cause existed that a person had committed an offense which made him removable from the United States. All these provisions were held to be implicitly preempted because of comprehensive federal regulation in a field occupied by federal statutes pursuant to explicit constitutional authorization. Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito each wrote separate dissents in the Arizona case. Most notably, Chief Justice Roberts did not dissent. The week of June 25th was not his week for challenging the Obama administration. Justice Scalia pointed out that since the Arizona laws in question did not conflict with any express preemption provision and did not exclude aliens whom federal law would admit or admit those whom federal law would exclude, it did not impliedly conflict with federal law and field preemption did not apply. The federal government, he argued, can hardly claim that it has comprehensively occupied the field of controlling our borders because it is manifestly not doing so. Finally, Justice Scalia pointed out that since President Obama had recently, just a week or two earlier, announced his intention not to enforce immigration laws as to 1.4 million illegal immigrants under the age of 30, the argument that Arizona contradicts federal law by enforcing laws compatible with the federal immigration laws that the president declines to enforce, in his words, boggles the mind. Justice Scalia was instantly and scathingly accused of being political and completely out of line by daring to make this point, especially since it was based on a fact not in the record. The criticism is, of course, completely nonsense, inasmuch as the president had publicly and loudly proclaimed a policy of not enforcing immigration laws passed by Congress at the same time his lawyers were claiming that Arizona's attempts to enforce provisions that Congress had passed would somehow inhibit enforcement, I should say non-enforcement, of those same laws. His comments were directly germane to the case and pertinent to his dissent. I'll briefly mention, two other decisions which I think will insulate or help to insulate citizens from overzealous targets of administrative federal regulatory authority. The first is that aforementioned FCC versus Fox case, the government's latest foolish effort in a decades-long campaign to save us from nasty language on the airwaves, including a commonly understood synonyms for baloney and breasts. This goes back to George Carlin and the 1978 Pacifica case and has its modern resurrection in the form of such aging cultural single-named icons, Cher and Bono. In Pacifica, the court ducked the issue, this is in 1978, the court ducked the issue of occasional expletives, and this year it ducked the issue of fleeting expletives. You can see how much progress we've made in 34 years. The holding this year in FCC versus Fox is that the FCC could not enforce its fleeting expletive rule because it hadn't given fair notice of its intention to prohibit or punish passing offensiveness. The court declared that people must have a clear notice of what is prohibited and not be subject to capricious or discriminatory enforcement by agencies that have not announced in advance what it was that they intended to punish. The argument made by the government that it would never actually try to enforce vague regulations, which the government always invokes when it is accused of asserting authority that would lead to ridiculous results, was brushed aside by the court as non-enforceable noblesse oblige. The government offered the same defense, by the way, in Citizens United, stating that, well, it could prohibit a book. It would never do anything like that. A similar message was sent to the EPA in Sackett versus EPA, which threatened enforcement of an impossibly vague provision of the Clean Water Act, threatening fines of up to $75,000 per day if owners of a two-thirds of an acre parcel of land in Idaho did not remove some dirt and rock they had deposited on their own building site. The EPA claimed that its draconian compliance order was immune from challenge in court because it was not final. The court rejected this effort, quote, to enable the strong-arming of regulated parties into voluntary compliance, holding that the EPA's quite visible, viable threats justified a pre-enforcement challenge. This is a potentially significant victory for those threatened with agency action. What the government likes to do is enforce a threat of severe regulatory sanctions in context in which a challenge would not be ripe or would be brought short of exhausting administrative remedies. The threat is out there. This often compels settlement on government's terms because the costs and risks of defense are too high. When a final action does occur, it is way too high. So allowing the regulated party to bring a challenge, and also with the FCC case, to bring a challenge based upon vague standards are very significant developments. Well, now, I suppose I should quit before I talk about the Obamacare case, or maybe that's what's holding you here, I don't know, or the hot weather outside. The Supreme Court's 187 Affordable Care Act decision, rendered after 5 hours of oral argument, abounds with legal and political ironies. First, foremost, and central to the result is the majority's conclusion that the individual mandate is a legitimate exercise of Congress's power to tax. During the legislative debate, the president and his allies were adamant that the mandate was absolutely not a tax. Had they marketed this provision as a tax, the bill would surely not have passed. There were no votes to spare. So the Supreme Court saved the signature legislative achievement of the Obama administration precisely because it was what the administration said it was not, and was not precisely what the administration said that it was. Early in the litigation, the administration invoked the Federal Anti-Injunction Act, which bars suits to restrain the collection of any tax. The government then argued that Obamacare was a tax, which precluded the challenge to the mandate. As a suit to enjoin a tax, the suit would be dead on arrival. But by the time the case got to the Supreme Court, the administration had switched its positions, and the Supreme Court held that the mandate was just what Congress said it was, a penalty. The choice of labels, the court said, cannot control as to whether the law is constitutional, but does control as to whether the Anti-Injunction Act applies. When I use a word, the court, like Humpty Dumpty, said, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. The magic of this dueling taxonomy of the word mandate means that because it is a penalty, the court could go forward to consider its legality. But because it is a tax and not a penalty, it is a lawful exercise of the taxing power, not an unlawful exercise of the power to regulate commerce. Are you getting confused? Try reading the 187 pages. Another irony is that the five justices concluded that Congress did not have the power under the Commerce Clause to regulate doing nothing, that is, not buying health insurance. But five justices, only the Chief Justice in both camps, held that Congress does have the power to impose a tax for doing the same nothing. Our constitutional law professor president, who insisted that Obamacare was constitutional, was right all along. But he was right because he was wrong. He was right that it was constitutional because he was wrong that it was not a tax. He either doesn't know his constitutional law that well, or his political instincts counseled not sharing that wisdom with the members of Congress who were voting on the measure. Incidentally, in my research, I became aware of three presidents in my lifetime who taught constitutional law before coming president: Obama, Clinton, and Eisenhower, who, it turns out, taught constitutional law at West Point. Where do you suppose you would get the best constitutional law education? Harvard, Yale, or the United States Military Academy? The rejoicing by liberals over this decision may be another irony and may be short-lived. Their version of the vastness of federal power was vindicated, but only if they want to propose politically unpopular taxes. On the other hand, the majority decision imposed a doctrinal limit on federal power to regulate commerce, and in another part of the court's opinion, to exercise power under the spending clause. These authorities are much easier to exercise in Congress. Unfunded mandates are one of the preferred ways of taxing in sheep's clothing. The court's decision, while affirming the authority that is hard to use, restricted authority that is easier to use. This looks suspiciously like a Trojan horse. As someone has said, you could teach a whole constitutional law course with the Obamacare decision, but you'll be relieved to know I don't intend to do that. I just want to mention three more points. First, the decision that the mandate to buy insurance or pay a penalty is a tax. There are lots of people out there who love the outcome, and they don't seem to care how the court got there. But very few at this point in the political legal spectrum are defending this requirement as a legitimate exercise of the power to tax. Taxes and penalties are clearly defined in the law, and they are generally mutually exclusive. A penalty is an enactment, otherwise authorized by the Constitution, to coerce the doing of an act. That is exactly the mission assigned to the mandate, to make people buy health insurance, so that everyone has to buy health insurance, whether they need it or not, so that the young and healthy, not the government, can pay for medical care for the vulnerable and sick. A tax, on the other hand, is designed to raise revenue, although taxes may have other incidental goals as well. The Obama mandate is most decidedly not intended to raise revenue. If it works as intended, everyone will buy health insurance. It will produce no revenue at all. The government barely argued that the mandate was a tax. The Solicitor General used 8 pages during the 3 days of argument to address the subject, and only at the very end of his argument, when prodded by Justice Sotomayor, he wouldn't have gotten to it, had she not said, "General, could you turn to the tax clause?" And he finally did. Justice Ginsburg's 61-page concurrence with the Chief Justice completely ignores the subject, and the four-justice dissent, in my view, eviscerates the Chief Justice's analysis as a tax. So the only defense of the taxing authority rationale is contained in 14 pages of the Chief's opinion, a full 5 of which are devoted to explaining why, if it is a tax, it doesn't violate the capitation or other direct tax provision of the Constitution, a very thorny issue. In short, for the far-reaching and largely unlitigated conclusion it pronounces, the Chief Justice's opinion has given us precious little reasoning or authority to back it up. I am not personally persuaded, and what a Pandora's box it opens. I think Doug alluded to some of this. If the Commerce Clause cannot be the justification for federal law making you buy insurance or broccoli, but the taxing power can instead be deployed to make you buy an insurance product you do not need or want, what is the limiting principle? The Chief Justice offers none that I could find in his opinion. At least with the Commerce Clause, there would have been some limits. But if Michelle Obama wants you to pay a tax if you don't eat the right food, or if Nancy Pelosi wants you to pay a penalty for not heating your home with energy from windmills, do you have any defense at all? None that the Chief Justice mentions. It did occur to me that the Chief Justice's decision that the mandate was constitutional as a tax is like the Higgs boson. I did this for lady. That was discovered by physicists this week in Switzerland. It is not clear what it is. You can't see it. It disappears as soon as it occurs. And it is the God particle. It is the answer to everything. The big question now, posed by CBS journalist Jan Crawford, is did the Chief Justice switch his vote after the argument and initial voting? If he did, why? And who are her two sources? The answer to the first part of the question is that the structure of the decision, how its components are written, and other factors suggest to me that the taxing authority rationale became the basis for the court's decision after considerable writing had been done and subsequent to a majority decision, or the draft of a majority decision, striking the euphemistically named shared responsibility payment as a violation of the Commerce Clause. It does not look to me as though this set of opinions started out as a decision upholding the mandate as a tax. If the Chief did switch, I don't know why. However, coming almost exactly 75 years after the historic switch in time that saved 9, after pressure on the New Deal Supreme Court from President Roosevelt, the Obamacare decision, in the face of overt pressure on the Chief Justice and the court by the current president and many of his surrogates, makes it awkward. If there was a switch, the appearance doesn't look good. On the other hand, I have the highest personal and professional respect for Chief Justice Roberts and have to presume that his thinking and actions were motivated by his view of the Constitution and nothing more. Finally, I have not the slightest idea who may have been Jan Crawford's two sources. I will only say that it is a terrible stain on the court if members of the court's intimate judicial family leaked internal deliberations to the press. In conclusion, there has been much said recently about the politicization of the court, with 5 Republicans and 4 Democratic appointees. Every time there is a decision in a controversial case along those lines, Republicans 5, Democrats 4, the losers will cry politics. Every time the court splits 5-4 in favor of the left, with one of the 5 Republican justices in support, the mantra is judicial independence, statesmanship, and integrity. Much of this is the product of passion by the media to crown political winners and political losers in every case. If politics is what the public reads every day, every time, politics is what they will believe. And the politicians who challenge the integrity of the court from political platforms or wage partisan campaigns against disfavored court decisions are the ones making the court appear political. The justices cannot defend themselves from these charges, and it does grave damage to the institution to make such charges, whether it comes from a former constitutional law professor or not. Thank you. I have a suspicion of what Gene has in mind, so I'm not leaving.
Well, we do have a tradition in the chapter of giving our speakers a copy of the Federalist Papers, but we've had a tradition with Ted in recent years of giving him a bottle of wine, and one of the reasons is that if you have 7, 8, 9, 10 copies of the Federalist Papers, it kind of loses some of the point. But that is not the case with this.
Thank you, Gene.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can have enough copies of the Federalist Papers, apparently, but you can never have enough bottles of wine. Thank you for staying. Thank you.